Commercial free ABC on Radio National, but something tells me you probably recognise that earworm of a jingle for Australia's hardware heavyweight, Bunnings. Bunnings is one of Australia's best known brand names and also, I suppose these days, synonymous with weekend sausage sizzle fundraisers. The story behind the Bunnings name is told in a new book by University of Western Australia historian Joe Christensen. It's called Not Just a Bunnings Man, The Life and Times of Tom G.M. Bunning. And it's described as exploring the life and times of one of the most respected industrialists and public figures in 20th century Western Australia, as well as uncovering the personal side of the Bunnings story. Joe Christensen, welcome to Sunday Extra.
Thank you, Julian. Nice to be with you.
It's great to have you. Now, look, I suspect I'm one of the very few people ever to have read the About Us page of the Bunnings website. And Joe, while it says that they're Australia's and New Zealand's leading retailer of home improvement and lifestyle products, I'm sorry to say, there's not a single mention of Tom G.M. Bunning. Why do you think that is?
Look, it's an interesting question. I mean, I think there's two answers to give. One is that Tom lived in the shadow of his elder brother, Charles, who was really the figurehead of the company for much of the 20th century. I mean, the company was known as Bunning Brothers. It had been established by Tom's father and uncle, Robert and Arthur Bunning, in the late 19th century. And then Charles and Tom had run it together in partnership for much of the 20th century. But of course, this was in the era when seniority really mattered. So Charles was the company chairman. He was more in the public limelight, better known, I think, certainly around Western Australia. And then Tom was more involved behind the scenes for many years before he assumed the chairmanship on his brother's retirement in the 1980s. So that's one reason. I think a second reason is that he would have liked it that way. He was an unassuming character. He didn't seek the limelight in any sense. He was a very dedicated businessman and company administrator, but not one who was in the habit of putting himself out there in the public spotlight, as it were. So I think that that's another reason why he's not perhaps being given the credit that is his due.
So why did you decide to write the biography of the less publicly known brother, Tom Bunning?
Yeah, so it came through an approach from the family. I think they were keen to see their father given a little bit more credit. I think they were aware of his tremendous contribution, not just to the growth of one of Australia's most successful businesses, a business that has gone on to become a national icon. Partly, I think they were keen to correct the record, as it were. There's been certain attempts to claim credit for the stunning success that Bunnings has become in the 21st century. But of course, there is an earlier history of the company in the 20th century that had only been partially told. I think they wanted to have that record corrected. The Bunnings name in Western Australia stemmed from the arrival of Robert and Arthur Bunning, the two brothers, in Western Australia in 1886. Now, they were initially planning to go on to the East Coast and perhaps to set up business there. They were carpenters by training, and they established quite quickly a very successful building contracting company, which won the commission to build a number of quite prominent public buildings, both in the capital of Perth and in outlying parts of Western Australia. And that kept them occupied for the next decade or so, and meant that Robert and Arthur settled in Western Australia permanently. In the early part of the 20th century, they branched out and moved into the building supplies trade. Robert purchased a number of brickworks, and then in 1904, he purchased his first sawmill in the hills above Perth. What he then found was that the sawmilling side of his business was the more profitable. And so by the time that Tom was born, in 1910, the Bunning brothers had largely given up their building contracting business. They had sold off their brickyards and they had moved wholesale into the sawmilling and timber supply trade. That was the company that Tom then became familiar with as he grew up in the 1920s and 1930s, and the company that he came to work for after he'd finished his school in 1929.
And I suppose we can see there the beginnings of the evolution of a business, although it hasn't quite got us yet to the all-conquering big box hardware store that we're so familiar with today. Let's talk a little bit more about Tom's work in the company. In the foreword to your book, one of G.M. Bunning's descendants, another G. Bunning, writes about the early years of the Great Depression and Tom Bunning having to Save the Family Company. Tell us what that was about.
Yeah, so it was a privately owned company. One of the challenges that Bunning Brothers faced was in the area of finance. It was very difficult to obtain loans from banks, and terms were often quite strict. In the early 1900s, Robert Bunning had been forced to actually go to private money lenders to keep the business afloat. But he had managed in the 1920s, after the economy recovered at the end of the First World War and there was a period of prosperity for the timber industry, he had managed to obtain a loan from the Bank of New South Wales, that provided the liquidity that he needed. When the Depression occurred, the Bank of New South Wales became very nervous about the prospects of the timber industry. The industry at large relied heavily on the export of timber to overseas markets. Bunning Brothers were only partially involved in that trade, but they were also quite dependent on the local residential construction market, which had collapsed in the Great Depression. So the bank sought to foreclose on their loan to the company, which would have been it for Bunning Brothers. And Tom, who had entered the company as an accountant just before the Great Depression, suddenly found himself thrust into this role of having to obtain another financial backer, which he was able to do. He secured a loan with the English, Scottish and Australian Bank, the forerunner to ANZ. And that then kept the company afloat through those very difficult years of the Great Depression. So it was a real test, a real challenge for a quite junior member of the company, but one which then also set it up for the prosperity which came in the years that followed.
On Sunday Extra, we're speaking with Joe Christensen, who's written the new history, not just a Bunnings man, the life and times of Tom G.M. Bunning. And one of the extraordinary aspects of Tom Bunning's life, Joe, was his experiences in the Second World War and the 3.5 years he spent in the notorious Changi POW camp. Could you tell us about that and the historical records you found in researching it?
Tom Bunning enters the military, the Australia, or the second AIF, at the beginning of the Second World War and is appointed a captain in the 2nd 4th Machine Gun Battalion, which is one of the units which is sent to Singapore to defend against the Japanese attack in late 1941 and the beginning of 1942. Of course, that defence was in vain. Tom, along with many thousands of Australians, was captured and sent immediately to the Changi Prisoner of War Camp. Almost from the beginning of his captivity, he begins to keep a diary. And this diary is an extraordinary document. It's not kept surreptitiously, although he is quite guarded in what he says about his Japanese captors. It's kept in the form of a series of letters or notes to his wife so that she would understand the experience that he was going through. And he maintains this diary across 3.5 years until the end of the Second World War. Now, his experience in some ways is atypical of an Australian prisoner of war. Tom spent the entirety of his captivity within Changi. Most Australians who were sent there initially after the fall of Singapore or the rapid Japanese advance throughout the Malay Peninsula and Southeast Asia were then later sent off to labour camps in the Malay Peninsula or in other parts of Southeast Asia, places like the Thai-Burma Railway. And of course, we associate these with the tremendous brutality and inhumanity of the treatment that the POWs suffered. This was not Tom's experience. And I think it's quite an interesting insight to realise that conditions at Changi actually weren't that bad compared to those that prevailed in the labour camps in other parts of Southeast Asia. So, across 3.5 years, he keeps his diary. It's just an amazing insight into the experiences of the POW. It documents, you know, daily life, the steadily worsening conditions as the war turns against the Japanese and food supplies become increasingly restricted. The prisoners are really suffering. You know, there's problems with their health, problems with their morale. The shock when those who remained at Changi learnt about the fate of the Australians and other Allied prisoners of war who had been sent away. When some of those returned to Changi, the survivors return and their shock and anguish of what they had learned had been the fate of their comrades. It's all captured in this diary. It really is an extraordinary document. And an aspect of his life, which I've tried to cover in the biography.
Yeah, there are really fascinating insights from that time, including the importance of maintaining a mentally sharp mind. And we hear about Tom giving lectures about accountancy and the West Australian timber industry while he's a prisoner of war.
Yeah, so he had a voracious appetite for knowledge. And again, in Changi, there was a series of educational programs set up to keep the men occupied. There are also sports that were played. So he played cricket in Changi. There was one reference in the diary to rugby union being played until too many prisoners became injured. So they put an end to the rugby union. But the educational program was one that he really embraced. And he had expertise on the Western Australian timber industry that he was prepared to share. So he notes giving a lecture that he admits went for well over an hour to a group of prisoners.
And some of the prisoners thought it might have gone a bit long. Is that right?
It went on for a little bit long. He's going to shorten it for the next time he gave it. But a group of prisoners sitting on the floor of one of the rooms inside Changi, you know, barefoot and in tattered uniforms. And he gave them a lecture about the finer details of the Western Australian timber industry as a way of keeping them occupied and as a part of the educational program that had been put in place within the prisoner of war camp.
And you also reproduce sketches that he made, imagining the new Bunnings headquarters while he was in prison. It really is, as you say, an extraordinary historical document. Joe, there's not a huge amount of political intrigue in the Bunnings story, but we do hear about a little bit of tension between Bunnings and a Hawke government. And I must admit, it wasn't the Hawke government that I was expecting, Joe. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, so the Bunnings company benefited, I think, from a long period of liberal ascendancy in the post-World War II era. These are the governments of David Brown of Charles Court. But before that, there was a government led by Albert Hawke, a Labor Premier, in the early 1950s, which was certainly in the eyes of Bunnings and a lot of the other businesses in Western Australia, hostile to free enterprise. They were seeking, in some ways, to revive an earlier system of what was referred to as state socialism or state enterprise in Western Australia, which had been established by the Scadden Labor government just prior to the First World War, where the government would actually own and operate businesses in competition with free enterprise. And in the timber industry, that meant that there was a state sawmills operating in competition with companies like Bunnings. The Hawke government, as well as supporting state-run enterprises, including what had by then morphed into the state building suppliers enterprise, which combined brickmaking and the production of timber for the building industry, the government was quite keen to crack down on what they saw as the excessive profits being generated by private companies supplying what was a quite feverish post-World War II building boom. Tom Bunning wasn't an overtly political figure, but he did enter the fray, so to speak, in the early 1950s on behalf of free enterprise and through the agency of an organisation known as the Western Australian Trade Bureau, where the main objective was to oppose the Hawke government's unfair profit legislation. And eventually they succeeded in that campaign and helped to usher in that long period of liberal ascendancy that I've referred to already.
Yes, I think it's fair to say that while Western Australia did have a Hawke government, the government of Albert Hawke in the 1950s, the Hawke government term probably better associated with Albert's nephew, Bob, who of course went on to be Prime Minister of Australia, but a fascinating connection nevertheless. Joe, how was the Bunnings name and brand as we know it today actually born? And how does that line up with the life of Tom Bunning that you've written?
Yeah, look, it's an interesting story. I mean, the company had won a reputation for fair dealing, you know, fair prices. It was seen to be a good employer. It treated its workforce fairly. It was quite progressive in terms of its stance on workplace safety. The timber industry could be quite a dangerous industry to work in. Bunnings were at the forefront of promoting safety standards in the industry. They were, of course, a homegrown company in the era that Tom and Charles ran Bunnings Brothers. They were a homegrown company in an industry that was dominated by large overseas interests, in particular the Miller's Timber and Trading Company, which was a London-based conglomerate which dominated the timber industry, and there were various other companies involved who were controlled by outside interests.
Yeah, it's quite funny thinking of Bunnings as the little guy.
Yeah, and they were exactly, they were the little guy, and they had to fight for their share of the market step by step along the way, and that's the story that's detailed in the biography. There's also, I think, an interesting relationship between the company's profile and the image of themselves they like to promote and the growing environmental movement in Western Australia. So if we just fast forward to the 1970s, you have within the community and within the scientific community in particular, growing concern over the impact of logging on the state forest. Western Australia's state forests are quite vast. I mean, 1.2 million hectares of Jarrah and Karri forests were managed by the state government in the interest of the timber industry. But by the 1970s, there was growing concern for the protection of what remained of the old growth forest. And there was an incident in 1975 where Bunnings, who had recently been successful in establishing the woodchip industry in Western Australia as a partner in a new enterprise, the West Australian Chip and Pulp Company, that would log quite extensive areas of native forest and send those off to Japan to be manufactured into paper. An incident where a group of environmentalists actually placed a bomb on the new woodchip loader at Bunbury as a protest against a new industry. So faced with a growing environmental movement, the company actually began to promote itself in ways that I think resonate with that image of Bunnings we have today, the trusted homegrown company, you know, the sort of the good guys. That really positive image of Bunnings stems from this earlier period. And I think they became quite successful in promoting themselves in this way.
And just finally, Joe, was Tom Bunning part of the sale of the Bunnings business to Wesfarmers, which I suppose was the seed that led to the Bunnings that we know today?
Look, he had a role in it. Bunnings in the 1980s is caught up in the quite tumultuous business scene, which is taking place right across Australia, particularly in Western Australia, where you have a new breed of aggressive corporate raider appearing on the scene. So figures like Robert Holmes and Court or Alan Bond, who, you know, acquiring vast fortunes of their own, but are quite aggressive in taking over companies, including local companies, stripping off their assets, selling it off for a profit, and enriching themselves. And Bunnings, in this period, by this stage, they had become the largest timber company in Western Australia. They controlled the lion's share of the timber resources available in the state, and they are a target for a hostile takeover by the New Zealand asset stripper Ron Brearley. And in order to forestall Brearley's interest, which subsequently evaporates following the Black Monday stock market crash in October 1987, but before that occurred, Tom Bunnings, to forestall the asset strippers, seeks a friendly partner, and that leads him to Wesfarmers, another Western Australian company with a positive reputation, deep ties to the community, respected on the business scene. And Tom arranges the placement of 10% of shares of Bunnings in Wesfarmers. So now Bunnings is seen to be more secure from corporate takeover. But it was known at the time that Wesfarmers might itself have a tilt at Bunnings one day. That eventually comes a few years after Tom Bunnings' death, where Wesfarmers successful in taking over the majority of the Bunnings shares, and those shares which remain in the hands of the Bunnings family are subsequently sold off in the years that follow. So it becomes a wholly owned Wesfarmers entity. And it's at that stage that it begins its national expansion and becomes the Bunnings that we know today.
Joe, thanks very much for telling us the Bunnings story. It's been great speaking with you.
Thank you, Julian. Thank you very much.
That's UWA historian Joe Christensen, who's the author of the biography, Not Just a Bunnings Man, The Life and Times of Tom G.M. Bunning.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.